Even by the extraordinary standards of Peruvian presidential turnover, it has been quite a week. The government palace in Lima rotated through three tenants in a matter of days. President Martin Vizcarra was removed via impeachment. His replacement, Manuel Merino, resigned following violent protests. He was succeeded by Francisco Sagasti, who appears to remain incumbent as of this recording. Serving as Peru's head of state seems not to bring out the best in people. Of Peru's six presidents prior to Martin Vizcarra, four are in prison and or awaiting trial, and one shot himself while being presented with an arrest warrant. This circus would be dysfunctional enough were it not for the fact that Peru's presidential intray is presently teetering with problems other than those caused by the people supposed to be running the place. The country has one of the world's worst COVID-19 outbreaks, and its economy has been accordingly battered. Is it possible that Francisco Sagasti represents an end to Peru's lousy luck with its leaders? How has the country's politics become so chronically chaotic? And where does anyone even start cleaning up a mess like this? This is the Foreign Desk.
The massive demonstrations that we have seen in the past few days in response to the latest political turmoil exposed deep discontent with the political class, following several years of institutional clashes, of corruption scandals. So risks and anger are much higher now.
Five of the last six presidents, not including Vizcarra, their post-presidencies have been dominated by corruption accusations. One is in jail, serving a 25-year sentence. Another shot himself dead last year. I think most Peruvians, they understand that the corruption just pervades the state.
The real moment of change has come now when the youths in the street and the people all over around Peru have begun to say, we want to change the structure of the state that Fujimori left us. It will really be the end of Fujimorismo if that constitution is brought down and a new one is put forward.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Maria Luisa Puig and Simeon Tegel. Maria Luisa Puig is Latin America Director at Eurasia Group, based in London, and Simeon Tegel is a journalist based in Lima. He writes for the Washington Post, among others. Simeon, I'll start with you in Lima. It has been a pretty chaotic and turbulent time. How does Lima seem to you now? Does it feel like things are calming down?
Yeah, I'd say Lima on the streets, it's pretty much back to normal and everything has calmed down. I think Merino resigning on Sunday really lanced the boil. And then the designation of Francisco Sagasti as the new interim president, I think, really just sealed that. Congress did try on Monday at the last minute to appoint someone else, a president more to their liking, like Merino. But it didn't work out for them. I think it had become pretty clear in the previous few days that Peruvian people were absolutely not going to have that.
Just to follow that up, Simeon, why did those protests become so violent? Because this wasn't just pushing and shoving. People were killed.
That's correct. And I think most neutral observers who were there have all been pinning the blame on the police. I mean, these were huge nationwide demonstrations. I'm sure there were some protesters somewhere being violent, but overwhelmingly the protests were peaceful until the police came along and basically tried to repress, using violence, peaceful protesters. We now know that they were using buckshot, amongst other things, as well as tear gas, and also disappearing, a very Latin American word, some protesters, i.e. undercover officers arresting them and then taking them off to police stations. And the information wasn't just being made public. So pretty much the blame is all being placed on the police. And the chief prosecutor here is now opening a preliminary criminal investigation into the police, but also, and she's named them explicitly, Manuel Merino, his prime minister and his interior minister, for the violence, including potential charges of homicide.
Maria, let's back up a few days or a few weeks to what kicked this protests and these upheavals off. And this was the impeachment and removal of President Vizcarra. Is it possible to delineate quickly and clearly who was behind his removal and what they were hoping to gain from it?
Yeah, it was Congress primarily. So what I would say is that Vizcarra took office in 2018 following the resignation of Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. And he built public support, strong public support, on an anti-corruption platform and by confronting discredited lawmakers in particular. So there were allegations of wrongdoing, most specifically that he allegedly took bribes for works that had been awarded during his time as regional governor. And these allegations of wrongdoing gave Congress an opportunity to strike back. He also enraged lawmakers, I'll say, in his presentation before Congress when he was facing the impeachment motion by calling attention to the fact that many of these lawmakers are facing their own investigations, are still remaining in office. So many lawmakers just want him out.
It may be, Maria, to follow that up, this may be a self-answering question in that it may explain why it was that people were so keen to get rid of him. But President Vizcarra had, of course, pledged to root out corruption in Peruvian public life, which, as we will come to learn, is no small undertaking. But was he actually getting anywhere? Was he making progress?
Well, he did put forward anti-corruption reforms, some of which were approved. That included an overhaul of the system for selecting judges, for instance, stricter rules on campaign financing, a ban on the immediate election, re-election of lawmakers. So yeah, it could be that some of these initiatives were not particularly liked by certain people.
Simeon, you obviously in Lima live with the day-to-day reality of this corruption in Peruvian public life, and certainly seen from a distance, Peru seems to be one of those places where you could say not so much that the system is corrupt, but that corruption has actually become the system. If you actually live there, how pervasive is it in public life? Is there now just a general assumption that the whole apparatus is completely bent?
It's a complex picture, but I think it's absolutely fair to say that there is just entrenched systemic corruption throughout Peru, from the municipalities up to cabinet level and obviously the presidential level. Five of the last six presidents, not including Vizcarra, their post-presidencies have been dominated by corruption accusations. One is in jail, serving a 25-year sentence for corruption and also human rights abuses. Another is fighting extradition from California for having accused of taking $30 million in bribes. Another shot himself dead last year, Alan Garcia, famously or infamously, as he was being arrested for corruption allegations. I think most Peruvians, they understand that the corruption just pervades the state. There are some agencies where you don't see it, but most you do. And just the most obvious thing, I think, for Peruvians, the way it's most present is just with the traffic police here. I mean, everyone in Peru knows that if a traffic cop pulls you over, what he's after, he's not trying to give you a ticket or maybe have a kindly word to say, maybe you're going a bit too fast or whatever, but he's looking for money. I mean, that's just understood here. So, I mean, the police is just one of many institutions, along with the courts and absolutely Congress, that really needs to be cleaned up. Just one thing to say about Congress and taking offense to Vizcarra's speech. One of the things he referenced was that there are 130 members of Congress. It's a single chamber. He referenced that 68 of them, and this has been reported in the media here, 68 members of Congress have various criminal investigations currently open into them for all kinds of crimes. A lot of it's kind of corruption-based, asset laundering or money laundering. But there's even one very prominent member of Congress here who's doing quite well in the presidential polls, who's accused of homicide, killing a journalist when he was in the army back in the 1980s. And Vizcarra mentioned that during his speech. And we heard a lot of the members of Congress saying about how deeply offended they were by this, which, I mean, you'd hope if you're in that position in the national legislature, you might have a slightly thicker skin than that and be able to focus on the issues rather than your pride.
Simeon Tagle and Maria Luisa Puig, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. If any one person is culpable for Peru's current difficulties, it may well be Alberto Fujimori. He was president of Peru from 1990 to 2000 and is now a prisoner, serving 25 years on charges including, but by no means limited to, murder, kidnapping, extortion and embezzlement. Here's Natalia Sobrevia Perea, Professor of Latin American History at the University of Kent, with a look at one of the most bizarre political careers in recent world history.
Peru is a very interesting country. It's a challenge. It's an interesting challenge. So many difficult problems.
Alberto Fujimori was elected to the presidency of Peru in 1990, and he was a surprise candidate. Nobody really expected that the agronomist, vice chancellor of the Agrarian University in Lima, mathematician, would become the president. He ran against a Nobel Literature Prize winner, Mario Vargas Llosa, in 1990, and he was absolutely unknown back then. But the elections in 1990 were underpinned by absolute economic collapse, Shining Path, guerrillas. The country was really imploding in 1990. And the then president, Alan Garcia, and the APRA party were convinced that they did not want to have Mario Vargas Llosa elected. So they supported Alberto Fujimori, who had promised that he would do whatever. Literally, he hadn't really said anything. And he came out of nowhere to be elected. But he had a long-standing feud with Parliament, and he decided on the 5th of April of 1992 to close Parliament and put forward a coup in which he took over all the power. This year, 1992, was extremely violent in Peru. It was just about when Sendero Luminoso was about to be defeated. It was eventually defeated, and Fujimori had no hand in this, but he used it as his credentials for being anti-terrorism.
Determinar definitivamente con cualquier vestigio de terrorismo en Perú.
He closed Congress and he was forced to call for a new constitutional convention, which met in 1993, and they approved a new constitution that changed the country and gave it a real neoliberal backing, but crucially allowed for his immediate re-election. So Alberto Fujimori ran again in 1995, and he was elected overwhelmingly, even though there were still allegations that he had tinkered with the voting. But he did win, and he had a second term in government. Now, in 1997, Alberto Fujimori decided that he wanted to run again. And this is when things started to become difficult for him, because he needed the constitutional tribunal to do what was called the authentic interpretation of the constitution. Meaning, in 1990, he had been elected under one constitution. In 1995, he had been elected by a different constitution. Hence, he was going to be allowed to run again in the year 2000, because each period is for 5 years. And this was the beginning of the real attack to Fujimori's idea of staying in power. In 1999, when the campaign started, everybody thought that Fujimori was going to win and that this was a foregone conclusion. And the year 2000 saw huge mobilizations, mainly of young people, but also all around the country, of people that were tired of Fujimori, tired of this idea that he used, that he was the only person that could defend Peru against terrorism. So Fujimori pushed for this re-election in 2000. And this, again, there were lots of accusations of electoral fraud. And there were huge street protests in July 2000 when he took power. He fell in September 2000 when the videos of his wrongdoing, and actually his main intelligence officer, Vladimiro Montesinos, came to light. He had not had support from enough congressmen, so he started buying their loyalty. And the way that Montesinos did it was by presenting people with piles of money and filming them while he was doing that. So this was the end of Fujimori. Suddenly everybody, a lot of people that had supported him, started abandoning Fujimori and saying, this is unacceptable. He claimed that it wasn't him, that it was Montesinos. Montesinos ran away. Fujimori pretended to run after him.
El operativo continuará
until Fujimori decided to go to the APEC meeting in Malaysia and decided to stay in Japan. And he sent his resignation to the Peruvian Congress via fax. This led to huge turmoil. Nobody really knew what to do. But what was agreed was that Congress would take over with a caretaker president. And this was the way in which Valentin Paniagua was elected, actually 20 years ago this week. The Fujimori saga continues. So he went to Japan in 2000. He is a dual Japanese-Peruvian citizen, and there was a very concerted attempt to try to bring him back to face justice in Peru that lasted from the year 2000, 2001, and all the way until 2004, when Fujimori surprised everyone, deciding to return to South America with the hope of being able to run in the 2005 election. And he flew back to Chile, and he was put under house arrest in Chile. Now, Fujimori never imagined that this was going to happen. He had a lot of closeness to the Chilean politicians. Eventually, he was extradited from Chile to Peru. He was investigated. There was a whole judicial process against him, and he was tried. The trial lasted all the way until 2009. But on April that year, he was found guilty of the main crime that put him in jail comprehensively, were the killings of 9 students and a professor in 1992.
Y los secuestros de Gustavo Andrés Gorriti el Embogen y Samuel Dyer Ampudia.
And the killings of some people that were having a get-together in a poor neighborhood in Lima. So these two crimes, he was prosecuted for them, he was found guilty, and he was put in jail for 25 years. Because these are human rights abuses, he is not allowed a presidential pardon. Well, Fujimori, as we mentioned, has been in jail for more than a decade now. But his daughter, Keiko Fujimori, ran for the presidency in 2011 and in 2016, and she was nearly elected. More comprehensively in 2016, she was defeated by Pedro Pablo Kuczynski by just fractions of a percentage point. And she and her party, the Fujimorista party, dominated Congress in 2016. So the political crisis that we're living today in Peru is directly a result of Keiko Fujimori's defeat in 2016. Now, Alberto Fujimori has 4 children, 2 of them who are politicians, Keiko, his eldest, and Kenji, his youngest son. And Kenji is a congressman, and at some point, his and Keiko's idea of what was the best way of dealing with their father diverged. And this was also very crucial because Kenji decided to take some of the legislators to support Kuczynski in exchange for a pardon for his father. Keiko was against this, so, you know, kind of the feud between the Fujimori children had to do with this as well. And what Kenji did was use the power that he had to try to liberate his father. And he got Kuczynski on his side. Kuczynski gave Fujimori a pardon in December 2017. Keiko did not approve of this, but eventually Fujimori was out, at least for some months, until the Constitutional Tribunal decided that he should be returned to jail. Kuczynski lost a lot of his political capital on the Fujimori pardon and was eventually vacated from power, mainly by the Fujimoristas themselves and those that were kind of divided between Keiko and Kenji. So that was an interesting thing of how Fujimori exerts power through his children, but there's also a division between them. And I think that the biggest legacy that Fujimori left was the 1993 Constitution. And the real moment of change has come now when the youths in the street and the people all over around Peru have begun to say, we want a new constitution. We want to change the structure of the state that Fujimori left us. And it will really be the end of Fujimorismo, I believe, if that constitution is brought down and a new one is put forward. That will really be the end of Fujimorismo.
That was Natalia Sobrevilla-Perea. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Simeon Tagle and Maria Luisa Puig. In this part of the show, I want to talk a bit about what the future may hold for Peru. Francisco Sagasti is, of course, the new president, for the time being at least. Maria, I will ask you first of all, the corruption and ineptitude we were talking about in the first part of the show, that kind of thing does tend to breed a terrible fatalism among the people in the countries where things have fallen into this kind of abeyance. Is there any meaningful hope attached, do you think, by Peru's people to Peru's new president?
Yeah, I think that in a way the peak of Sagasti for new president will reduce, even if not dispel, the risk of additional near-term instability. He was among the 19 lawmakers that voted against impeachment. He is also a centrist, so therefore he has less resistance from people to either side of the spectrum. I guess that this profile will probably be well received among protesters, among people that are unhappy. But the massive demonstrations that we have seen in the past few days in response to the latest political turmoil exposed deep discontent with the political class following several years of institutional clashes, of corruption scandals, which has been compounded by the worst economic crisis in decades and healthcare emergency because of the pandemic. So risks and anger are much higher now.
But Simeon, one of the many hurdles that the new president faces, of course, is that he can't exactly plan for the long term. There's a new presidential slash general election due in April. So I guess there's two things we have to look at. One, given the recent fortunes of Peruvian presidents, what are his chances of lasting until April? And given especially that he is 76 years old, is he someone who's going to run for the job or is he basically a placeholder?
So he's not going to run for the job. He was running to be, I think, vice president on his party's ticket, which was kind of a long shot anyway. Though if he does well in the next 8 months, his party, they're called the Purple Party, I mean, he might propel his party to do very well and even potentially be the biggest party in the next election. That's if he does well. I think the biggest or the one single threat I can think to him seeing out the next 8 months is the return of Vizcarra. I suspect they'd probably prefer Sagasti to stay in office, but I think they'd also accept the return of Vizcarra. What they absolutely will not accept, and I think Congress has really understood this now, is another figure like Merino, who's basically there to try and put the brakes on the reform agenda and basically protect what an overwhelming majority of Peruvians now view as utterly corrupt and rotten political class.
So, Maria, is it as simple then as saying that this is essentially a division now between Peru's presidency and its people on one side and Peru's Congress on the other?
I think that it is that what we have seen is the trigger of several years of clashes, of very weak party system, of corruption scandals, and this is more about the people against a very discredited political class. Who do you include in that discredited political class varies, but it is more about saying, you know, like enough is enough to discredited politicians.
Simeon, that enough is enough sentiment would be perfectly understandable among Peruvians by now, but do you perceive any danger of that ending up in a dark place? Because especially in countries which do have a history of dictatorship and specifically of military dictatorship, there is sometimes a temptation to lapse into thinking, well, we've tried democracy, it really hasn't worked, let's give the other thing a try. Is there any nostalgia for that kind of government in Peru at all?
Yes, there's a lot of it, and it's been a risk that Peru has been flirting with for a long time, certainly for the last two decades since the fall of Alberto Fujimori. I mean, polls here show that Peruvians have a relatively high tolerance for authoritarian strongmen, and even many of them have a desire for that. And they think that that's basically what is required to clean up a democracy that is proving very unsatisfactory for many Peruvians. So I think that is a real risk, that we fall into this vicious circle of just corrupt government that doesn't respond to citizens' needs. And then citizens, or a large number of them, respond by thinking, well, democracy isn't working. We need a savior, a strongman savior. So that's a real risk in Peru, and it's kind of been an ever-present in recent Peruvian history. It probably goes back longer than that as well. I think right now, the next elections next year, there's just so much uncertainty and very unpredictable. I think the best chance Peru has of having a competent democratic government after July 28th next year, which is Peru's Independence Day, is probably if Sagasti is able to do a good job, including positioning his own party well. Political parties, there's so many of them, and they're so weak in Peru that a lot of the time voters also vote on the basis of an individual well-known presidential candidate. And the Purple Party, Sagasti's party, probably doesn't have that. It's got two people competing for the nomination right now, but probably neither one, I suspect, is going to be that. But Sagasti, by his own performance, if he does well, could allow the party to have a pretty good representation in the next Congress.
Maria, do we have an idea yet of what Sagasti wants to do with what may be an extremely short term in office and obviously facing extraordinary challenges? I mean, the corruption and other issues we've been talking about would be more than enough in themselves without stirring in a pandemic and associated economic crisis. What actual options does he have?
Yeah, this is an interim administration, so there are many things that he may want to do, but there are only a few things that you can do with very few months to an election and to a change of government, and also given that the Congress hasn't changed composition. So what I would expect is for his administration to really focus on mitigating the impact of the pandemic, so addressing the healthcare and the economic emergency, and ensuring that elections, which have been already called for April, are being held in a free way. So that are basically his main tasks. I wouldn't expect for this government to push for any major reforms because there isn't enough time, and probably there will not be enough support in Congress either for this. So it's just primarily pandemic and elections.
Well, Simeon, in between now and those elections, does it strike you that there are any potential upcoming crisis points that might upset the dynamic afresh?
I think one thing that's going to be a constant is that this Congress is going to continue causing problems to the president and, frankly, for the country. They're going to push it as far as they can. I think how far they can now push it, it's pretty clear, not as far as they thought they could. But I mean, Sagasti, he's got the next 8 months, he's going to have Congress sniping and causing all kinds of problems. In terms of a big crisis point, I don't know. The economy could be one. Peru's lockdown has been so strict. So, I mean, there could be economic issues, but I think the biggest is going to be an institutional and political issue of this Congress just carrying on, but perhaps in less spectacular ways, its destructive path.
And just as a final thought, I guess, to wrap it up, Maria, is the kind of shenanigans we have been talking about in this program, is it still something to which ordinary Peruvian people feel like actually matters to them? Or is Peruvian politics, and again, it happens a lot in countries where corruption has become this kind of endemic, that the people start to regard politics as kind of this self-contained circus which doesn't really have any particular interest for them? Has Peru reached that point yet?
I think that the demonstrations that we have seen expose that the streets are much more active than they have been in decades or in history. So the latest political turmoil has really been the cherry of the cake for people to actually expose that discontent and likely to get more involved in politics.
Simeon, where you are in Lima, is that something that you're noticing as well, just as you go about your business to the extent that that's presently possible?
I think so. I mean, Peruvians, at least they have the reputation, or they'd view themselves, I think, as generally being fairly apolitical. But I mean, the last few days have obviously shown that there are limits to that. And I think part of these limits are generational. I mean, the protesters were from all races and classes and all over the country. But they were led, most of the protesters were young. They were from their late teens, maybe, to mid-30s, I would guess. And one of the chants that really sent out quite a powerful signal was, you messed with the wrong generation. And so I think there is a generational change that we're seeing now in Peruvian politics, but also in Peruvians' interest in politics. for various reasons, and I'm sure social media has something to do with it. And I think the political class now has been put on notice.
Simeon Tagle and Maria Luisa Puig, thank you both very much for joining us on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans and Yolin Goffan. Christy also edits the programme and produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.